You know what I'm saying. I'm just thinking. If a waveguide to really be an efficient transmission line, it has a cross-section of four walls. It's a four-sided thing. You can make another kind of transmission, which really is flat plate, twin lead, so to speak. An upper flat surface and a lower flat surface is another kind of transmission line. But even in that case, you'd like each of those surfaces to be highly conductive. The ionosphere is conductive. Is it conductive enough to make a low loss transmission line at 12 kilohertz? That's a tough one. So could you use the space between the ionosphere and the Earth? Let me think. The good thing about the twin lead, flat plate transmission line is the spacing does not have to be a fraction of a wavelength, as it does in the case of real waveguide. The longest dimension inside and the cross-sectional dimension has to be a half wavelength or greater. So you can't use it as waveguide, but using it as twin lead transmission line, for all we know, they might already be doing that, Wes. So that's one hell of a transmitter there, Joe. You visited that site. Make a rough guess. The amount of land that they're controlling for that super antenna at 12 kilohertz, do you think they're controlling the nearest mile, the nearest 10 miles, the nearest 30 miles? Make a guess, Joe. The B2LYY, K2LIW, and how long ago were you there?
Oh, I didn't visit the site. I saw this site when I was out with a guy out in Bar Harbor fishing in a small boat, which is just off a desert island. And I remember looking to the east. I asked him what this thing was, and he says, that's a Navy station. But he didn't say anything more about it. I saw this thing, which looks like when I'm looking at the diagram, but from a ground level looking horizontally at it, it looked like a bunch of white poles or something like that. I mean, you couldn't see what was on the top going from pole to pole to pole, but it looked huge. It looked like it was about 1 to 2 miles in diameter with the string of poles. So I did see what the illustration says in the book here, but I was never actually out on this property itself. I had to be about maybe 3 or 4 miles away from it, but you can see it optically from the water out by Bar Harbor.
Very good, Joe. To get on that second subject I gave a hint about earlier, this conversation I was hearing during the week of a guy with a dipole-like antenna because of his restrictions of his landlord, the wife, and whatever, he thinks he can't put an antenna outside the house. So therefore, it's inside the house, and because there's a whole lot of nearby metal, he's positive his antenna is going to be low in efficiency. Good-sounding common sense. Pretty much wrong. When you put an antenna in the attic of your house like that, let's say, for instance, you're operating on 40 meters, 80 meters, 20 meters, there's some good news and some bad news. The bad news is you're going to have a lot of NAG coupled into that wiring, into the pipes, into the household wiring and so on. And quite possibly when you're transmitting 100 watts or more, the fluorescent light in the living room, the fluorescent light in the kitchen is going to get brighter. The telephone is going to be interfered with. You might false alarm the computer that's doing your automatic turning on and turning off of the sprinkler system. All kinds of radio frequency interference is likely to happen because you have nearby wiring to that antenna and close coupling to the two. Let me drop. But the nearby metal creating low efficiency of your antenna, very unlikely. It's very similar to what happens when a guy sets up an 80-meter dipole, let me pick a number, 60 feet above the air, horizontally polarized dipole, and he wants to talk to his buddy in London that's due east of him, and due east of him is the Con Ed or LIPR wiring, the New Jersey Power Line, you know what I mean, the 110-volt wiring and the high-voltage wiring of the power lines outside of his house are at the exact same altitude. And the power line is directly in the direction toward London where he wants to talk to this guy. And so you would think that's going to give you a great big blockage. Absolutely not. The effective area of an antenna is gain lambda squared over 4 pi. Well, you plug in the number 80 meters and a half-wave dipole. The half-wave dipole has an effective area of 8,500 square feet. If your eyes operated at 80 meters and you looked at that antenna, you would see a great big black oval in space, probably 150 feet wide, probably 75 feet high. It has 8,500 square feet. That is the effective area of that antenna when it is receiving or when it is transmitting. And that the power wiring at the exact same altitude in the direction that he cares about most, that power wiring is non-resonant, which is very unlucky. Let me drop. And that power wiring is creating a shadow on the effective area of his antenna, and that shadow is a couple of square feet. His antenna has an effective area of 8,500 square feet. If you could run an experiment, measure the signal strength of his signal from that dipole on 80 meters to his buddy in London, with the power wiring there and with the power wiring not there, there would be a small fraction of a tenth of a dB of difference of the effective area of the gain in that direction because of that power wiring. If the power wiring is not resonant, that 8,500 square feet of that dipole, the dipole itself is made out of 14-gauge wire, it's casting a shadow on the ground of 1 square foot. Radio-wise, because of resonance, it has an effective area of 8,500 square feet. As long as that power wiring is also not resonant, no problem. Let me drop. Very similar to a whole lot of guys who want to put insulated guy wires on their tower because they think the wires are casting a great big shadow on their antenna and affecting the gain. Unless those guy wires just happen to be resonant at that frequency, no problem. And even if the guy wire was resonant, you could easily kill the resonance by putting another piece of wire, a pigtail in the middle of the guy wire hanging there doing nothing, would kill the resonance. It would shift it to some other lower frequency. Killing the resonance of a guy wire is very easy. And if without resonance, the wire is not there. It's casting a shadow of at best a square foot, and your antenna's got a huge number of those square feet. When you look at an antenna from an antenna area point of view, like you said, a whole brand new way of looking at things. And so that antenna in the dipole antenna in the attic of his house, let me drop, could easily have 95% efficiency, even though it's got a whole lot of nearby metal, just as long as that metal is not resonant. And so if he compared that dipole in the middle of his house in the attic, as opposed to at the exact same altitude in the backyard, if he compared the gain and efficiency and whatever signal strength, it would be almost the same. So yes, you're going to get coupling into wiring, and that's going to give you some grief. But if your cable TV system is not very well shielded, it might even give you simple RF overload of your television receiver. But nearby metal is not necessarily bad as long as it's not resonant. That, of course, is very different from common sense. I thought I would mention it because I heard this poor guy, crying in his beer, so to speak, because his antenna is always going to be very low in efficiency because of nearby metal. Not necessarily so. Okay. Any final comments you want to make or questions on Joe's question on this 12 kilohertz, 1.2 megahertz, 1.2 megawatt antenna in Maine? K2RIW listening. Okay, the next guy on our list was Rich, N2EO. Okay, over to you, Rich, and how are things there in Massapequa? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Did I miss my turn?
The order was Joe, carryover from last week, Rich, Andy, Joe, QYW, and George in that order. So I don't think you've missed your turn. The first guy who signed it tonight was Rich, N2EO. N2EO, go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, N2EO. I wanted to ask you what you think of an 8KK antenna. There's also something called a bobcat. And I don't know what that is. I didn't get a chance. No, bobtail. I didn't get a chance to look it up yet on the internet. But do I have room for that? And by the way, it's not much for the radio, but I may be relocating to a smaller piece of property, 80 by 60. I want to build an HAK for 40 meters.
An HAK antenna. John Krause, that was his call letters. WHJK. Really is each other, broadside, something like a quarter wavelength or an eighth wavelength, depending on which design. So do you have enough real estate for half-wave dipoles, 67 feet each, a pair of them, and probably spaced something like 30 or 20 feet apart? So a pair of dipoles, both parallel to the ground, 20 or 30 feet apart, 67 feet long, if I got that right, yes. Do you have enough room for that? The HJK antenna, depending on how you feed it, can give you a pretty good front-to-back ratio in one direction. And by feeding it in a different place, maybe with some relays, you can easily reverse the direction. So you can decide the antenna is going to give the strongest signal to the east, then you flip the switch, it gives you a stronger signal to the west. You flip the switch again and feed it halfway between the two dipoles on that twin lead between the two, and it becomes a bi-directional antenna, a figure eight pattern. So you can electronically steer it to be east, west, or simultaneously east and west in my example. So if you Google the word HJK or, the HJK antenna, it's probably got another name, you'll see a whole bunch of photographs of various ways of building it, feeding it, and so on. Very versatile antenna, fairly popular with some people. N2EO, K2LIW. Go ahead there, Rich.
Mystic. I think I do have room. And what is the gain, and whether the relays go inside or out? Complex to put the relays in, and can I feed it with open wire line to a tuner? Do I need a tuner?
And the question we had on this subject last week was somebody who wants to use the HJK on multiple bands, and there you definitely need a tuner. And feeding with open wire line is the most desirable way to feed this thing. The relays I'm talking about are not the usual design. I'm telling you that if you feed the transmission line, if the way you feed the HJK, if the feeder is closest to one of the dipoles, you'll have a lot of direction, directivity, forward to bend, front to back ratio. And let me think now. Yes, if you've got a pair of dipoles where the wire itself is north-south because you're trying to favor the east-west direction, and if you feed the most western dipole, your signal will be aimed to the east. Phased array antennas always fire in the direction of the phase delay. Because your feed line is closest to the western dipole, the eastern dipole is being fed with a delayed signal. Therefore, the signal will be strongest to the east. Then if you flip relays so that you feed the eastern dipole, the stronger signal will be to the west. The usual designs do not show the relays I'm talking about. I'm telling you that depending on where you connect your feed line, you can decide which direction you're going to favor, and if you wanted to electronically select it, you're going to put in relays so that your transmission line goes to either the most western dipole, the most eastern dipole, or halfway between the two, if you want to do that electronic steering. N2EO, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, what kind of relays? I have to get weatherproof relays, I would assume.
Now, if I had not told you about being able to steer it to the east, to the west, or simultaneously east and west, you would not be installing any relays. You would be connecting a transmission line to one particular place and using the antenna. The next step of the process is to use relays that will move your transmission line. The most efficient way to feed this is with open wire line. So now, by some means, you have to create a relay-like function that either connects your open wire transmission line to either the most eastern dipole or the most western dipole of this HJK assembly. And so, could you do it? You probably could do it by running a pair of transmission lines, one connected to the eastern, one connected to the western dipole, and do the switching in the shack. So if you're willing to run a pair of transmission lines, you can do all the shift switching in the shack. Therefore, you don't have to worry about weatherproofing the relays. And the nice thing about using open wire lines is the loss is so low, you now have more than enough ability to put your antenna tuner in the shack. And as long as you're only operating on one particular band, you might not need an antenna tuner. If you want to use it on multiple bands, you're forced to use an antenna tuner, I believe. Over to you, Rich, K2IAW.
Okay, Dick, N2EO. Yeah, so I just want to use the 40 meters. I'm a member of EastCoast, East Coast Amateur Radio Service. And generally, where I use it, what kind of relays for open wireline? Wouldn't want to use a coax relay.
I took an ordinary crystal can relay, a high-power version of it. The can itself was probably 2 inches in diameter, maybe 1.5 inches high. This was a double-pole, double-throw, 2-ampere relay, but it was in a sealed can. I used that as the transmit-receive relay on my half-kilowatt, 6-meter transmitter. Worked like a charm. When you're down at a frequency as low as 7 megacycles, any old relay can do the job for you, as long as you're smart enough with the way you physically lay out the relay, and maybe you'd have to put a little bit of shielding across it. As long as your relay can take the voltage and the current, it doesn't have to be a coaxial relay when you're down at 40 meters. If you're smart enough with the layout. Over to you, Rich, K2LAW.
Okay, Dick. Well, my amplifier works 80 through 10. It's 1,500 watts. So we'll talk more about this, okay?
Okay, good luck with that project there, Rich. Andy is the next guy on our list. N2 Hotel, Uniform Hotel. Go right ahead, Andy. K2LAW in the TechNAS.
Good evening. I'm recuperating from the flu, so I hope I sound coherent tonight. Latest phenomenon I wanted to describe with my ICOM Alpha Henry 2 automatic remote antenna tuner was, for example, if I'm on 1.9 megahertz and I hit the button and it tunes, the tuner control unit shows it's a successful tune, but the radio shows a 1.5 SWR and faults back a little bit of the power, let's say 25% of the power, somewhere along arbitrary along that line, falls back some of the power. So I noticed if I go up to 500 kcs or even a full megahertz up, and then tune it from up there to, let's say I tune it from 1.95 or almost 2 megahertz and then tune back down to 1.9, that I have a perfect match. I have a 1-to-1 SWR according to my radio, and it's putting out full output on the radio. So I'm not sure if that's what's going on there. If that's let me let it drop. I'm not sure if that's heuristics of the programming of the tuner. I'm not sure if that's a sign that maybe the coax cable is possibly not 50 ohms and defective, or it's just because everything's so out of whack with the resonance and impedance and such with on that band. But I do notice it happens on some other bands too, sometimes on 80, sometimes on 40, and I have to go up or down in frequency tune there and then drop back down to my actual operating frequency, sort of like I don't know who I'm fooling, the radio or the tuner in that case, but trying to get a grip on what's actually going on there. Maybe you can help me get a better idea of what's going on there, Dick, and 2HUH.
It's quite possible, Andy, that what you're describing is perfectly normal operation, and there might be a logical cause for it. Reminds me a little bit about driving in a rural area, and you get lost, and you roll down the window and talk to somebody and say, how do I get to so-and-so street? And because he's not completely familiar, he might say to you, you can't get there from here. That's a local down east joke in Maine. You can't get there from here. In the case of a automatic antenna tuner, where it's adjusting, if it happens to be a Pi network, and it's adjusting C1, C2, and the inductor, choosing the right tab for the inductor and so on, the way it knows which way to rotate the capacitor in order to hit resonance and correct impedance matching, what the antenna tuner is doing is it's looking at the signal being reflected somewhere in that system, either from the antenna or back toward the driving radio. It's looking at the signal being reflected, measuring the amplitude of the reflection and the phase angle. Once it knows that information, amplitude of reflected signal and phase angle, it knows which way to go with the capacitor. Okay? There are certain combinations of frequencies and antennas and standing wave ratios where the phase angle it measures is 180 degrees. And now the machine has got a problem. When you measure a phase angle between the transmitter and the reflected signal of 180 degrees, is it plus 180 or minus 180? As far as a polar diagram is concerned, that's the exact same spot. But if it's plus 180 and it really is 179.9, or if it's minus 180 and it's really minus 189.9, in one direction you're going to go clockwise, in the other direction you're going to...
Repeater, timeout.
In one direction the machine is going to go clockwise, in the other direction, and in the other case the machine is going to go counterclockwise. So it can get into a hang-up mode where it can't quite find the right way of tuning itself. When you now put it at another frequency, let it do its tuning, and then go back to the treble frequency, it's starting from the other direction. In other words, the capacitor, instead of being high, the capacitor is a little bit low. Instead of measuring plus 179, it measures minus 179, and it knows which way to go. So that's a guess on my part as to what's happening. What you've done is a very brilliant workaround on this one, as I see it, Andy. You've discovered that if you go to a friendly frequency and then come back to the treble frequency, a good percentage of the time, it will find the right solution. You probably could have also done that by moving a smaller number of megahertz. But still, there are certain magic frequencies with your antenna and your antenna tuner and your length of transmission line where the antenna tuner can get into a hang-up mode and can't quite find the solution or can't find the solution at all. Sits there and searches forever, if you know what I mean. So you found a way around that glitch in the program. It's not a glitch in the program. It's a glitch in the philosophy of how the thing works. N2HUH. That's a bunch of guesses on my part, but it fits the evidence you've given us so far. Over to you, Andy, K2LAW.
Oh, well, thank you, Dick. I think I understand that a little better now. And I think I'm going to go to sleep tonight a little happier that you said I found a brilliant solution. I'm not feeling well. I feel happy that you said that. And I'm also glad I don't have to try fixing anything to or repairing anything tonight. I don't feel like doing that either. Okay, and this antenna tuner also happens to be the one with the relays and the inductors and the fixed inductors and capacitors, and I guess it kind of works the same way. I don't think your explanation also applies to that style of tuning too. They both have their advantages and drawbacks from what I can see. But okay, very well said, and I think I got the idea. And sometimes the tuner works fine. You hit the button, it's 1-to-1 full output, no fallback, and it works great. And then sometimes I have to play games like this. But yes, it works great, and I'm happy that I'm able to get full output nonetheless with the tuner. So just another little trick, and maybe somebody else could use the same trick when they're doing similar experiments such as me. All right, thank you, and very well said, Dick. N2HUH.
almost every automatic antenna tuner, plus transmission line, plus antenna, will have a couple of non-magic frequencies where it has trouble finding a solution. The automatic antenna tuner does a beautiful job 95% of the time. That's my guess. But 5% of the time, there's a magic frequency where it goes into a hang-up mode and can't quite find the solution. If you went to the manual mode with an automatic antenna tuner, you would find the solution as long as you spend enough time twiddling the knobs and the switches. And so by its method of measuring phase angle and getting this ambiguity of plus 180 versus minus 180, it can get into a hang-up mode. So you have to accept the fact that an automatic antenna tuner will automatically tune 95% of the time, but maybe 5% of the time, for your particular combination, at some magic frequencies, it's going to have trouble. But there's ways, you found a great way to work around that, Andy. And so you've got to tell your fellow radio amateurs, when they get a hang-up mode in their antenna tuner, you've got the solution and what to do about it. Okay, Joe number two, or really Joe number one, is the next guy on the list, KC2QYW. Go right ahead, Joe, K2YW in the TechNet.
Roger, Roger. Hi, everybody, and love you guys. A quick question. I read something on the internet like a week ago, and I forgot where, but have you guys ever heard of this before? I don't know who did the research, but they heard like eight different frequencies from radio frequencies from outer space. I don't know if it's coming from FCC. My question to you, Dick, is who's doing this research, by the way? Like, who's trying to listen to radio frequencies from outer space? That's my question. Back to you, Dick.
If you go to the site for National Aeronautics and Space Administration, and you plug in the words and you search for the Deep Space Network, you'll find out that they are tracking a zillion satellites out there. Each satellite has its own favorite frequency. And so the various places like Goldstone, California, there's a place in Australia, there's a place in Spain. Every 120 degrees around the globe, NASA has a major ground station with a whole bunch of 240-foot and 120-foot diameter dishes that are from time to time listening to all these satellites. When it comes to listening to frequencies from space, there's a zillion frequencies of satellites that NASA is listening to. When it comes to radio astronomy, the radio astronomers are listening to all kinds of frequencies. And we've got a number of radio astronomy setups, like the National Radio Astronomy Observatory in Green Bank, West Virginia. I've been there a few times. And boy, they've got some beautiful-looking antennas. The biggest fully steerable antenna in the world, the 100-meter diameter dish, the great big Green Bank dish is there, and I saw it under construction. Let me drop. So when it comes to listening to nebulas and stars and whatever, and outbursts of gamma ray bursts and things like this, the radio astronomers are listening to a whole lot of different frequencies. Now, there's a small group of people doing a SETI search, a search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And there's a group in California that's doing that 24 hours a day. And now they're looking for particular signals coming from space that they believe is from a extraterrestrial intelligence. And so from time to time, they will find a frequency that looks like the real thing. Sometimes it's a false alarm, sometimes it's a spurious response, sometimes it's a harmonic of somebody's satellite, but they're looking for extraterrestrial intelligence signals. The belief is that somebody out there is either, two different societies on two different star systems communicating to each other, and we're listening to it as it's a party line, we're tapping in, so to speak, or there's even the slim possibility that some society out there is saying, hey, here I am, I'm transmitting a signal. Is there anybody on the frequency? So give me a couple more words as to what they said about eight frequencies, Joe. KC2QYW, K2YW in the TechNet.
Roger, Roger. Yeah, I think you hit it right on the button. By the way, do these people get paid for doing this, or they do it like volunteer? I was always curious about that. Yeah, I read it somewhere. I forgot where, but it was late in the night over the weekend, like last week. They were saying other people or other living beings out there. That's what they were saying, that they actually heard eight different frequencies out there from radio communications or something like that, you know. So, but they couldn't understand the language, you know. So that's to answer your question. These people were listening on to other like living sources out there out of space, you know. So I don't think we're the only ones that live out here, you know what I'm saying. So back to you, Dick.
Now, the SETI Institute in California is privately funded. So the people, these are paid people, they've got a salary, and they are privately funded. Jill Tarter, I think, is one of the prominent people there. And if you, TED Talks, if you go to TED Talk and you type in the word Jill Tarter, and do a search on her. She gave a beautiful TED Talk that gives you a lot of information about what the SETI Institute does, and as she, as the president of it or whatever, she'll tell you what she does, why it's so exciting, and so on. I wonder what news report you are listening to, Andy, when Christian Joe, what news report when you listen to, and you said eight frequencies. In other words, if they found one frequency that looks like it's got intelligence, there'd be a lot of cheering as long as it can be confirmed. Are you telling me that they have found eight separate frequencies on one occasion or eight occasions? What news report were you listening to? And what's unique about eight frequencies? Were they found all at once where maybe the system is doing some kind of an eight frequency hop in some kind of a sequential manner on this one radio emitter? KC2QIW, K2IW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Roger that, Roger that. I read it somewhere. I think it was eight different cases, I think. I'm not sure. I'm gonna have to try to find that website and read it again and get back with you guys again. Unless you guys beat me to it, you know. Really can't recall if it was eight different frequencies or it happened in one day eight times. Or whatever. I just can't remember. I read it like 3:30 in the morning, and then I went to sleep, and then this happened like a week ago. So I really can't remember. But the most important thing was I definitely remember what they were saying about that they heard some kind of radio that like from out of space, and they're all about six. So, I would have to, research it and get back to it. I feel like you guys beat me to it. So, I can, about the eight times, something like that. So, I'll give it back to you.
Yeah, there are two major groups in the United States. One is the SETI Institute, and the other one is the SETI League. The SETI League is a much smaller operation. Founded by a ham radio operator. I've met him. Wow, is that the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, coincidentally. We were both there for Astley. Astronomical Society, no, not Astley. The Amateur Radio Astronomers. Amateur Radio Astronomer Society. I can't think of the exact acronym in the call letters, but they hold a meeting roughly June of every single year in Greenback. The amateur radio astronomers and this particular ham radio operator, I can't think of his call letters right now, has something called the SETI League, where he has set up a number of parabolic dish antennas. He aims them all in the same direction and does a search for extraterrestrial signals. But the big operation is the one called the SETI Institute. And Jill Potter, I think is her name. And so if you do a TED search on that name and listen to her speech, and just do a TED search on SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. There's probably two or three of the TED Talks on that subject. An exciting concept that a society has to get to a certain level of technological advance, start radiating signals either because of broadcast or because they're communicating with other societies or just want to communicate with the universe, if you know what I mean. Here I am, is there anybody out there? So when it comes to sending a radio signal across the... Let me drop it. To send a radio signal across the zillions of light years of the distance between the stars. That's a sort of a practical way of doing it. Either a radio or laser beam, if you know what I mean, light pulses. That's a way of communicating over very long distances. As it is right now, the equipment that exists for mankind on planet Earth, I don't know the exact number, but I think we would be able to hear an extraterrestrial intelligence transmission from a similarly equipped society at some distance like 150 light years, which is a good long distance. The nearest star to us is 4 light years away. Within 150 light years, if that's the right number, there are thousands of stars. And because we now know that almost every single star has got planets, a significant number of those stars have got planets that are in the Goldilocks zone. They potentially contain life, and therefore there's something to listen to there. So that's one very exciting kind of radio, search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Good luck with that project, Joe. If you do listen to some of those talks on TED Talks on the subject of SETI search, tell us what was your impression. Wes, what was your question? N2XJM, K2RIW.
Hey, Roger. Yeah, I forgot to tell you, Dick, I saw pictures of their antennas, man. Oh, wow, those things are awesome. Yeah, wonder if we could have one of those antennas in the backyard. Yeah, those things are humongous. All right, so I'll pass it over to the other station.
Yeah, N2XJM. A few things. SETI Institute calls for new tools, talking about alien mindscapes cannot be reached. It is there, it is SETI.org, but it's disabled. I was trying to search for the alien mindscapes, and all of the links that comes out appear to be disabled, at least based on my search. There is another organization, that is Max Planck Institute for Extraterrestrial Physics, and that one is at Max Planck Institute for Physics and Astrophysics in Munich, Germany. N2XJM.
WS2N.
Go right ahead, Paul.
Another fellow that's really put a lot of money into this is this Paul Allen. He was originally with Microsoft, one of the initial people in, and he's built out in California. I know it's not too far from San Francisco. He's got about 40 or so of these antennas set up, and they all move with one another, and he's got a search for extraterrestrials going on there. His initial goal was to put up over 300 antennas, but I don't think he continued to fund it. So I think it's under some other group is now operating those antennas. I'll have to check. But he was big on that. So maybe the reports came from that. I haven't heard the reports. I listened to and go through all these different websites. I haven't seen anything that talked about anybody actually making a confirmed contact. So if he comes up with it, I'd like to hear it as well. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
Okay, K2QIQ with the information. Go right ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. Good evening to everybody on the web. That signal was detected actually on May 2015. I'm not sure the exact date, but I think they were trying to make contact with it about 39 times. Also, it turns out that it was the Rattan-600 radio telescope that was being used to measure the signals, but it was, I guess, verified by SETI, S-E-T-I, you know, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And but they seem to think it might have been noise from a star as well. Back to you, K2RW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, and we're thinking about July 7, 2016. That is the date of alien mindscapes by Natalie Carbo, director of Carl Sagan, and this thing is disabled. So, just interesting. Why?
There were a number of SETI organizations, the SETI Institute, the SETI League, and probably one or two more, and the fact that one of them had a website and the website is discontinued doesn't mean that SETI is discontinued. Just one particular group has a discontinued website. Glenn, the signals that they heard, give us a couple more words as to they now think it might be a natural emission of a star as opposed to an intelligent radio signal. Is that sort of what you're saying, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2IW in the TechNet.
Well, Dick, this isn't my area of expertise. I'm just reading from a website. The title of this website says, Mystery Solved. Strange alien signal finally traced. Did it really come from a star? And the radio telescope it was heard on was a Russian Rattan-600. There does appear to be somewhere in the order of about 39 contacts of people witnessing the signal, and they're not even sure if it was possibly caused by some kind of internal terrestrial signal. So here again, it's I guess people are still studying it. Because it really wasn't that long ago. We're only talking May 2015, and apparently there's quite a bit of data. So there you go, Dick. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, many of these groups have set up a situation where if they detect a signal that they think is a candidate for a real SETI signal, very few people are going to believe it until another installation somewhere else on planet Earth aims their antenna into the exact same point in the sky and confirms the exact same signal. Until you get a backup at some other site, you can't be sure whether or not you're getting some interference from a local broadcast station near your particular site, for instance. There's a zillion ways you can get a phony signal, because the SETI signal you're looking for, you think it's coming from, let me pick a number, 150 light years away, a really big distance. By definition, the signal's going to be very weak. You're going to be using a very big antenna, very carefully aimed, a very sensitive receiver, very carefully tuned in order to pick up that signal. When you're looking for a threshold amplitude signal under those conditions, there's a zillion ways you can get a false alarm. So people are not going to get real excited until you get a confirmation from at least one more radio astronomy setup somewhere else in the world picking up that signal that you claim is a real thing. In the case of the Russian signal, I vaguely remember hearing those reports about that Russian site, and I think they were having some trouble finding another site that could confirm it. Is that roughly what the website you found said, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet?
Yeah, very good, Dick. I'm reading through this right now. I'm trying to get the full story on this, because there's a couple of websites now with the story I'm going through. I haven't seen about anybody else trying to confirm it from another satellite station, although apparently it looks like they did. And they're saying that it's wherever the signal was coming from was from 95 light years away from Earth. And Russian Academy of Sciences, the SAORAS, that they're saying at this point it's interesting yet unverified discoveries at this point. That's the way that they're, classifying it. Back to you, Dick. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
For a very brief period of time, NASA was funding SETI searches, but I think they've come to the conclusion that the chance of success is so small the number of dollars required is so large, and NASA has so many projects they're running simultaneously, so many spacecraft they'd like to build, but for the time being, they're not funding it. It's a little bit of a dark horse. So therefore, an awful lot of these SETI searches are really privately funded. The SETI Institute, to my knowledge, is privately funded. And people like Bill Gates will come along and give them a big chunk of money to keep them in operation. So the number of people who have got that interest, unfortunately, is a relatively small percentage of the population. We need more radio amateurs out there doing this work. That's sort of what the SETI League was trying to do. George is the next guy on our list. Kilo Delta 2, Foxtrot India Uniform. Go right ahead, George. K2RIW in the tech van. George, are you still with us? KD2FIU? K2RIW in the tech van? As soon as George comes back, if he does, we'll go back to the question section. If not, we're going to go over to the space report. And if you guys were watching 60 Minutes tonight, the third program on 60 Minutes was the man who is relatively sure he has located the real ninth planet. The ninth planet used to be Pluto. Pluto got downgraded into a non-planet, planetismal or something like that. And so they believe they have discovered, by way of the disturbance of the orbits of other things out there, they believe they have found something that's 10 times the mass of the Earth, 50 billion miles away. They haven't seen it yet, but they believe there is a object out there in the Kuiper Belt. This is that belt of a whole bunch of planet-like things that are circulating the sun at a very large distance. And I think this thing has something like a 30,000-year orbital period because it's so far away. And so it looks like we're going to be finding more planets that are part of this solar system, but way out there. The Voyager spacecraft is only 12 billion miles out there, three times the distance to Pluto, and this new planet, they believe, is 50 billion miles away. That's down the road a piece. WS2N with the space report, number 334, I think it is. K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, 334. And I have a 334 and A and B. So we'll have to separate them. And yeah, I have heard the same report. And you have a 15,000 year orbit. Compare that to Jupiter, just not Jupiter, Pluto. Pluto is just under 300 year orbit. So it's way out there. And they're using the Subaru telescope to look for this thing, and they think there's another telescope that's coming online in a couple of years. They'll be able to use that. And even the James Webb Space Telescope would be commissioned to search for it as well, because it would give off some kind of heat signature, and James Webb will be real good at infrared. That's what it's really designed for. The reason I said 234A and B, I have it divided up here because what I wanted to do is, cover the regular space net report. At the same time, I have a year in review for 2016, if you want to do that, Dick. I can zip through this pretty quick from month to month, but to give you an idea of what we covered here on the net, regular listeners would be able to pick up right away because they've heard the topics. If you haven't, you can always write it down, and we can always ask questions. Back to you, Dick, for a comment. WS2N.
Your A and B sound very good, Paul. I should have mentioned earlier that all the technets are recorded for the last 10 and a fraction years. If you go to www.amateurradio.tangovictor, amateurradio.tangovictor, choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and you can play back the tech reports, the technet reports. And for the first few years, they were even categorized, they were even cataloged, cross-referenced as to what subjects were discussed. Now, by way of your monthly review, let me drop it. By way of your monthly review, a person listening to the recording of this particular TechNet can find out what subjects you were discussing each month, and maybe you can even mention whether you discussed that particular subject at the beginning of the month or at the end of the month. And if a person wants to hear your original comment on that subject, he can go to amateurradio.tangovictor, go to that month, play that particular recording, jump to the last couple of hours of the recording, which that's where the space report is located, and therefore hear your space report on that subject. So you're well documented, Paul, so go right ahead with A and B. WS2N with the space report, A and B, K2RIW and the Tech Man.
Yeah, very good, as well as the whole technical net. But yeah, this is the space portion of the TechNet, and we're going to try to go through this as quickly as possible. But starting in January 2016, we started talking about the EVAs that were coming up. In particular, this was the 35th spacewalk by the International Space Station to either maintain or build the space station. And they were working on cables for future installation of the International Docking Adapter, the ITER, which eventually later on in the year, you'll see that was finally installed. And the reason you need that is for the up-and-coming flights in a year or two of American flights from American soil with American astronauts and also foreign astronauts on board our ships going up to the International Space Station. So this particular one was done by Tim Peake and Tim Culper. Culper wound up with water in his helmet, very similar to what happened back in 2013 with Luca Pomerato, the ESA astronaut. Or he was in worse shape than Tim Culper. He had quite a bit of water in his helmet, and they actually terminated that. Immediately brought him back, so he came very close to possibly losing his life. But they got him back in time, and he's fine. In fact, I just saw him. Let me drop it. Capcom talking to this week's EVA. We have an EVA going up, going on. Was it Friday? And another one going this week. And he was Capcom talking to those two. Then in January we had Falcon 9 go up, and their goal was to, of course, put satellites into orbit. And they had a first stage come back down to the drone barge out at sea off the coast of Florida, and it hit hard and crashed. It was one of their earlier attempts. They knew they had a good shot of doing it because the previous year in December they did succeed in bringing it back to Cape Canaveral. Now, also in January, a topic that was on 60 Minutes was actually on a year ago, and we talked about it here on the net, so it might seem familiar that we're talking about it again. That was the ninth planet that was believed to exist. At that time, they had a half a dozen bodies floating around near in a certain orbit, and mathematically, as they showed on 60 Minutes, not only these six objects, but now many more fall into that mathematical. What this guy believes is the answer to the problem of where exactly this new ninth planet is that might exist quite a few times bigger than Earth, and they're presently looking for that. So we covered that before, but we talked about that actually a year ago. Let me drop it. Okay, now we got into February, and that's when the story came out about LIGO. LIGO is the system that they have for detecting gravity waves. It's the laser interferometer gravitational wave observatory, and they have one located in Louisiana and another one in the state of Washington. And these two things are so sensitive that they could pick up gravitational waves. They've been working on these things for like 20 years and trying to improve them and make them more sensitive. And they got it to the point where it was sensitive enough to actually detect these gravity waves. And they found out that what they were detecting was two black holes probably crashing into each other. And each one was like, I don't know, 30 times bigger than the sun, or more massive than the sun. Even so, as far as size, though, it might only be a couple hundred miles in diameter. And these things gave off a tremendous amount of energy, creating gravitational waves that billions of years later, now that they're passing Earth, we were able to detect them. Let me drop it. This is WS2N. I gotta remember the ID here. Also in February, Japan, all these countries, we do talk about more, not only in the United States, but Japan has launched many flights, and one of those flights they launched was something called Astro H. It was an astronomy mission, and it was designed to be very similar to our Chandra space telescope, which has been operating since the 1990s. It's going to pick up X-ray type of rays, use that for detecting things in astronomy. It got off okay, very good. And then, sure enough, after it launched, they were getting good readings, and they found out that the mission started to fail. The spacecraft telescope started spinning and ripped itself apart with centrifugal force and completely broke apart. So it was a completely failed mission. So, last I heard, they're working on a Astro H2. So I guess probably many years from now they'll be able to try again. Also in February, beginning of March, Scott Kelly and Mikhail Kornienko, he's the Russian, Scott Kelly is the American astronaut. They came back from their almost 1 year in space. They were launched in 2015 and they came back early in 2016, and in good health. I read all the reports afterwards. You know, they lose bone loss and everything, but they did a lot of studies on him and his brother. His brother is Mark.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
What goes on in space to one person compared to an identical twin here on Earth? So, I'm sure he's glad to be back and retired after that. Also in March, they launched another Falcon 9. That's SpaceX, when I talk about the Falcon 9, owned by Elon. Tried to land another booster to try to recover it in the ocean. And this one also did not survive. He had maybe a half a dozen tries before he started to succeed with landing these things on the boat, but as of March, that did not happen. Toward the middle of March, the European Space Agency had a deal with Russia to launch the Trace and Schiaparelli spacecraft from Russia on a Proton rocket. That went up in March. The idea was to send these two spacecraft to Mars, put one into orbit and another one land on the planet Mars. Wasn't a rover, but it was a proof of concept to see if they could do it. They've tried in the past with Beagle 2 and failed, and this one they hope would work. Got half a mile above the surface, and apparently things went wrong and got bad signals
shut its engines down, shut the descent engines down early.